become a newsreader unless you had a beautiful voice. Even he had that little anxiety that a lot of performers have. I mean, being paid to tell stories to the world is a fantastic pleasure.
Conversations, an occasional Radio Moment series in which you hear from those who made a difference. Peter Griffiths.
I was born in Cardiff in the mid-1950s, in a working-class environment, although I think my mother and father had worked very hard to get enough money to buy a house and to give us a good childhood, and good education was really important. But childhood was full of music for us because my father was a singer, my mother was a teacher and a piano teacher. And they were both very active in the choral scene, and South Wales was very, very busy, had a very busy music scene. There was a lot of choirs singing, every church and chapel had a choir. So that choral generation of my parents, post-war, was a very important influence on everybody in South Wales. Things have changed a little since. But I remember going to hear my father and rehearsing with my mother at the piano. He would be rehearsing a song he was going to sing. He sang in all the great oratorios around, you know, the cathedrals and chapels of Wales. In the post-war years, he'd been in London during the war, originally from Aberystwyth, so he was a Welsh speaker. But he came to Cardiff. He started singing for the BBC. So he would do solo spots on the radio, in English at first. And then in the late 50s, he joined the cast of a television programme called Land of Song, Gwlad y Gân. This was a Welsh language musical entertainment programme. And my father was used to sing solos occasionally for that programme. So we were, as kids, we were sat down in front of the television every fourth Sunday, it was once a month, at 6:15 on a Sunday evening to watch my dad on television singing in Land of Song.
Sit my, welcome to Land of Song. The summer in Llantelli has probably been better than most parts of Wales, or for that matter, the British Isles. So good in
what
fact,
I remember about radio in the house was that, of course, this before 1967, it was the light programme and the home service that people listened to. We had a big radio set on top of the fridge. Every Sunday lunchtime, we would have a roast beef dinner. My mother would cook. And the radio would always be on. And being a Sunday lunchtime, what you would be hearing were things like Round the Horn, The Navy Lark, The Clitheroe Kid. This was the soundtrack of those Sundays.
Right, Alfie, me tea's brewed, me toast under the griller. Now for the really exciting part of me cookery lesson.
And the other thing I remember particularly was the early evening of a Sunday, because in those days my father wanted to save as much money as he could. He thought that going to the barber was a little bit of an expense that we could do without, so he bought the kit, the sharp scissors, the long comb, the little clippers and that kind of thing. And so on a Sunday evening when the time came, he would lay a big white sheet down on the floor of the kitchen. He'd plunk a kitchen chair right in the middle. He'd then put a big white sheet around me, and then he'd start clipping away. But I associate the memories of my hair being cut with the Mike Sams singers. Sing Something Simple. Do you remember this? On the light programme. Sing something simple.
Sing something simple.
Now, at the end of university in 1978, when I graduated, unemployment was a worrying high in the late 70s. But I'd followed my father's advice and I'd applied to join this trainee studio manager's course that the BBC used to do, two a year those days. They don't do anything like that now. So I applied for it and I was lucky to get an interview. So I graduated in July 1978 in Cardiff University, and a week later I was in London beginning work at the BBC. The training course was really a sort of a three-month course. So in the Langham Hotel, which is now a hotel again, it was a grand hotel originally, then the BBC bought it, owned it for a while, and it was their training school and dormitory for overnight announcers, that kind of thing. You spent 8 weeks training in the dummy studios they had there, which is fascinating, and then you spent 8 weeks working at Bush House in the BBC World Service and the external services, doing all the night shifts and things like that, and then 8 weeks in Broadcasting House on the domestic services, Radio 4, Radio 2, Radio 3, sometimes Radio 1. And you worked right across the programme fields, whether it was current affairs or sport or music radio. I remember, for example, being dazzled by some of the people I met. I remember being the studio manager deputed to go down to a basement studio. And I just got down there really early because I was nervous. I'd not been left alone to do this kind of thing before. And I had no idea who was coming in. And the door opened and there was Harry Secombe. So Harry came in and he said, sorry I'm a bit early, but my friend Peter Sellers has just died and there's a lot of people out there wanting to talk to me and I just need to get away from them and have a bit of a think. got a couple of cups of coffee, and then we just sat and talked. And do you know, I can't remember anything much that he said to me, because I was so dazzled by him.
My lord, ladies and gentlemen, back from the dead, we present half an hour of continuous radio fighting. The Doom!
David Attenborough came in to do his Desert Island Discs programme. But he came in, and I was in there on my own, and I saw him through the window. I thought, God, it's him. There he is. And he came and put his head around the door, and he said, hello, I'm David. And I said, I thought, well, I know who you are, mate, but thanks for pointing it out. And I said, oh, hello, I'm Peter. Desert Island Discs was then, it was Roy Plumley still doing it in those days. He started it, obviously, in the 40s. In those days, I think they would research the interviewee, having chosen who it should be. I think a researcher went to meet the interviewee, had a long conversation with them so they could come back and then write the brief for the presenter. And then the interview could be organised and arranged and plotted. And then the person would be brought into the BBC and they'd sit down and they'd record. And in those days, we did play the music in as part of the thing. And there were no early fades. You just played the whole track and then they would carry on the interview. Now I think you can do it in a number of ways. They certainly don't play the whole track anymore. And it's always been like a kind of an honour, a gong. It's the BBC equivalent of giving somebody an OBE if you're selected to be on Desert Island Discs.
If you could take just one disc, which would it be?
If I had to pick the one that I'd run into the waves to rescue when all the rest are washed away, it would probably be something that reminded me of Wales and probably my father. And there's a wonderful Welsh song by a composer called Idris Lewis, who my father had worked with, called Bugail Aberdyfi, the Shepherd of Aberdyfi. There's a beautiful recording of it by Bryn Terfel. It's the most beautiful thing, and I heard my father sing it a lot when I was a kid, so it would remind me of my home in Wales, my father as a singer, and it's just a lovely, lovely song, and it brings me to tears every time I hear it.
I'r gadair siglog tân a'r ffynnydd Aberdyfi.
So there I was in London, working with the BBC as a trainee studio manager. And I had worked on all sorts of programmes, but I was really keen to become a producer. I wanted to tell stories. I wanted to make programmes. I was very interested in the act of making and how you tell a story well. So I remember there was a point where there were three production attachments advertised internally in the BBC. And the third one was trainee producer on Woman's Hour. Or as I like to say, the token man on Woman's Hour. There always was a man, by the way, on Woman's Hour, right back from the very beginning. I learnt a lot there because on Woman's Hour, it's a general magazine programme. You do all the forms of radio you can think of. So there was a Tuesday call phone-in that they produced. So you did phone-ins. You did live production. And I shared an office with a woman called Pat Taylor. I mean, I'm not the tallest producer in the world. I'm about 5'6". All the women who produced Woman's Hour, they seemed at least 7 feet tall to me. They were grand women. They were of the old school. Pat Taylor and Sally Thompson and people like that. And inside the office, there was an inner office where the presenter, Sue McGregor, sat. She was the first presenter I'd spent any time with. Now, Sue, I've got to know Sue a bit better in later years and worked with her since, but she seemed quite remote to me. She was very cool. I do remember that there were one or two people who kept ringing the office who really wanted to get to see Sue because they really wanted to have a fling with her. Leonard Rossiter was one. Don't tell Sue I told you that. There were a few others like that. So you had this mixture of little insights into the life of a public figure. And obviously to watch how professional she was in the studio, that was the biggest thing for me. She was incredibly secure in a live studio.
It's always seemed to me that your characters are very alive, and this is why they're so popular with children. Is this because they're based on real people?
A lot of them are based on real
people. You had chunks of pre-recorded material, but you also had maybe a couple of live interviews and maybe a short interview as well. So, and it was all about timings, and I remember the two columns. You know, this is the timings you think should happen, and then you note down the times as they actually happen, and you can see whether you're ahead or behind, and you work out how you make up the time later on. Because it is all about detail in the end, isn't it? Getting it right. So that was good. And I was there at the time. I remember certain people coming in. Winnie Mandela came in to be interviewed in 1981 at some point. The one that didn't work out pretty well was I wanted to do a discussion on the Turin Shroud, I seem to remember. You know, was it real or was it fake? The author of a book came in to discuss his theory that it had to be real. There's nothing fake about this. And I got somebody else involved as well who was going to take a contrary view. And I wanted to get Spike Milligan in. He had written a piece in the Sunday Times the weekend before, because he was a devout Catholic. And he had a very interesting point of view about how it was essential that people shouldn't criticise this. This is a pillar of the Catholic faith and so on and so on. So I thought that might be an interesting voice to hear. And so I invited him in. I wrote to him and I invited him in. As we wrote to people and phoned them up in those days. There was no email, of course, no mobile phones. And then the editor thought, I think because he's Spike Milligan, it's going to skew the discussion, isn't it? Because he's a comedian. So she asked me to stand him down, which I did. And then I got this scorching letter from Spike. I wish I'd kept it, because it was beautifully written. How dare you? I'd done some preparation on this, and now you're telling me I'm not going to be part of this discussion. And I thought, oh, crikey, I've overstepped the mark here. So I learnt there as well, you know, be clear about what you want and why you want it, and don't just reach for things because they're available.
This is the advanced mentor class, Your Majesty.
In the 80s, the BBC was almost in places like a university. You had these long corridors up and down on all the floors, and then off the corridors were little offices, book-lined walls and all their notebooks there, lots of stuff, piles of tape, all big sort of 10-inch reels of old recording tape. And you, when you went in to see one of these producers, it was like visiting a university professor. A lot of the preachers didn't know how to edit a tape for themselves. Because I'd been a studio manager, I knew it was all about razor blades and splicing blocks and, you know, all of that kind of thing. And I thought of myself as being quite good at it, like many people would. But these people were ideas people. They were authors. So there was this quite hierarchical sense of producer, engineer, secretary, deputy editor, editor, quite a long sort of pyramid of responsibility and authority. If you were working in documentaries on Radio 4, Radio 1 was almost like another language. You didn't quite know how to speak, but you admired the people who did know how to speak it and knew what they were doing. Radio 1 was big news. You just knew there was a big circus going on just over the road in Egton House.
Radio 1, Britain's favourite music.
In the early 80s, you didn't really become a newsreader unless you had a beautiful voice, a beautiful instrument to play, shall we say. David Simons would refer to, he's got the pipes.
And a very good afternoon from me, David Simons. Here again with another blistering 2 hours of fun and frivolity. It's cold, though. Very taters.
Eugene Fraser would say to me, you know, I'm the instrument, you play me. So the art of directing a voice was, I never had that chance to do that before. Because then the received pronunciation, the influence of the idea that received pronunciation is how you had to sound in the BBC was quite big. Now it's very different. Everybody wants regional accents, and that changed at some point in the 80s and 90s. So you had these people with very, very beautiful voices. Some of them had been actors. The ability, like a theatre director, to direct an actor, to shape a line in this way, or to give a little a difference of tone in that way. Don't say it like this, say it like that. Whatever the shape of a line, the cadence, if you like, of the way people speak, which is very important in radio, as you know. Laurie McMillan and Harriet Cass, Dilly Barlow, who I became very friendly with and did a lot of work with Dilly over the years. And I remember one thing, Libby Purvis was writing a column in the Times in those days, and she referred to the voice of Eugene Fraser. She said, when Eugene Fraser starts speaking on the radio, it's like lying back in a warm bath.
The Met Office issued the following gale warning to shipping at 1600 GMT today, Tuesday the 21st of January. Dover, White, Biscay, Fastnet. Gale now ceased, but southwest gale.
That came to an end around about the middle of 1985. And I'd always been interested in the sport. I was looking for the next thing, really. And there was a job advertised in the radio sport and outside broadcast department, and I applied and I got it. And that began sort of a 5 or 6 year journey for me, which is one of the most significant, I think, in my radio life. Because I think I learned more about broadcasting in those years than anywhere else. The head of sport was a woman called Patricia Ewing. She was the first woman to be a head of any sports department anywhere, so she was a significant figure. She'd been the sports organiser, she'd come from local radio in Carlisle, she'd been in the Wrens before that. She was a very organised woman, quite stern, but very friendly. So I was recruited by her to be a junior producer, to sit on the desk where they did not just sport, but ceremonial outside broadcast coverage. So I was producing programmes like Sport on 4 on a Saturday morning. But essentially, I was there to live a childhood dream of working on coverage of some of the great sporting events in the calendar. My main focus was really on this programme, Sport on 4, which was the Saturday morning wake-up programme. But what I loved was this sense of a whole world opening out with Outside Broadcast. And when you think about it, Outside Broadcast, which began with the BBC in the late 1920s, this was one of the great driving forces in the development of BBC radio technology throughout the 20s, 30s and 40s. There were some of the great figures of Outside Broadcast. You know, Brian Johnson, the commentator, was still there when I got there. Henry Blofeld was there. All of these characters were fantastic. Peter Bromley, the racing commentator. What a voice.
And Corbière is clear. And Corbière is on the run in about 5 lengths clear of Grease Paint for Ireland. Yeoman is third. Then Hello Dandy in fourth. Gritar is fifth. Political Pop sixth. Hello Christie and Petey Sandy come next. And as they reach the elbow, it's Corbière. 4 lengths clear. He's got 200...
And what a technique he had for describing the race and dragging your heart out, your beating heart with you all the way to the finish line. Commentary is a very interesting thing. I think sometimes now the craft of commentary, it is a specific craft, is probably slightly misunderstood now. But there was a great tradition of it, which I entered working with some of these people. Perhaps the best commentator I ever worked with was Peter Jones, well known as a football commentator in those days. Peter was a very tall, good-looking man, originally from Swansea. He'd become a teacher at what they like to call a minor public school. And he was a languages teacher, so he loved the use of language. And he got into commentary at some point in the 60s. And he was the first choice commentator for any big football match. He was the first choice for any big state occasion. So if there was a grand opening or an Olympic opening ceremony or it was a royal wedding or a funeral, he would be the main commentator. And he had this very fluent way with words, but he picked up on a commentary tradition that went back right the way to 1927, when the very first commentary on sporting events happened. The very first one was the England-Wales match at Twickenham in January 1927. And Teddy Wakelam, who was the original commentator, the only bit of advice they gave him, they put a notice up in front of him in his commentary box up on a stand, and it had two words on it: don't swear. That was their main instruction, but he basically had to make it up. However, a lot of thinking went into it by Lobby, the head of Outside Broadcast in those days. I mean, imagine, Teddy Wakelam was sitting inside a box that they'd built for him specially. He had a big glass window across the front. Sitting in front of Teddy Wakelam was a blind man employed to be the assessor of whether the commentary was working. Sitting alongside Teddy Wakelam was a man who had in front of him a map of the rugby pitch, divided into 8 squares. So the idea being you at home could open up your Radio Times and see the squares of the match field actually in front of you. And the voice, while Wakelam is describing the action, the voice behind was saying, square one, square three, square four, back to square one.
Chosen three. Chosen taps it through to Marshall. Marshall back to Chosen one. Questle's there, but Chosen's...
And the role of the blind man is to try and tell the commentator afterwards, not during the commentary, but to say, I couldn't see anything. I couldn't see what you're describing. You could tell me there's a rugby match going on, but I couldn't see where the ball was. I couldn't see the action. This whole skill was developed over time about how you create a picture. So you would start with the basic facts. You know, this is where we are. This is why we're here. This is the event that's happening. You would then describe the entire arena that's in front of you, the proper description of the field and where you are geographically in relation to the field. So away to my left, away to my right. So that you build a framework. And then within that, you then describe the action. But in radio, you're also creating a narrative. You're telling the story of the match as well as just saying where the ball is. Peter Jones helped me understand this. He said, in a football match, he said, basically, people don't really care where the ball is that much, if it's somewhere in the middle of the park between the two penalty areas. But when the ball is in either of the penalties, they need to know exactly where the ball is. So keep your powder dry. And in between, you might talk about a player, about the way they carry themselves, what they look like, the personality that you're thinking. So you're building the characters of a play, in a way. And then when the ball gets into the crucial areas, then you go into actually describing where it is, what's happening to it. And the other thing he said is that you have to try and create almost like a cinematic effect. You have to illumine the picture in people's minds. So the way he would do it, he said he would describe the scene. Let's say before the FA Cup final, there was a marching band on the pitch before the camp. You could hear it. He would tell you it was there. but then he would tell you something about it to switch a light on. He said, do refer to colours, but don't refer to too many. Sometimes one is enough. You create the scene and then you say, and there, down there, is a bright yellow object. You know, you see the yellow. So this judicious use of detail and colour was part of the technique.
Now that is as good a goal as you'll ever see. Anybody who loves football will have loved that. This man, Maradona, is a star.
The other great figure of my time in sport was Cliff Morgan. We used to have lots of conversations about commentary and the difference between radio and television commentary. And he was always very good at coming up with telling examples. The principle with television commentary, he would say, is you've got to add to the picture. There's no point in describing what people can see for themselves. Best example, David Coleman commentating on an Olympic, one of the middle distance gold medal events. And as the guy who won it sort of was exhausted, almost fell over the line to win gold medal, Coleman's line across those pictures was, there you see the current price of gold. Now that's a brilliant line.
Good morning, everyone. A new year and a new time on Saturday mornings for Sport on 4. My name is Cliff Morgan. Welcome.
So the commentary as a craft was really developed through the need for the BBC to cover sports events, and that's true from the 1920s right through to the present day. However, in the 30s and obviously beyond, it became very important to commentate on other occasions, especially state occasions. This is before news was doing its thing around the world. The technology and the skills of outside broadcast working were all resident in the sports department, which is why when I got there in 1985, the home of ceremonial events coverage, royal events, state occasions, state visits, they were all produced by the sports department. Not because people thought of them as sports content, but because the skill set was the same. You know, the team we bring together has quite a lot of sports producers, broadcasters, and engineers who are used to doing this kind of thing on a daily basis. The guy who sits at the mixing desk, or the producer of the studio director who sits at the mixing desk, really, ideally, needs to be somebody from sport, because they're doing this every day of the week. So we have a list. We have a virtual team now. So when one of these things happens, they don't come along very often, and I'm still involved in shaping plans for those things. In 1990, the BBC decided to launch a new network called Radio 5. It's the precursor of what is now Radio 5 Live. David Hatch, who was then the managing director of radio, asked Pat Ewing, who was the head of Sport Nobe, he's my boss, to be the controller of this new network. She had virtually no resources. She had only the producers from the continuing education department, because it was meant to have education and sport on it, to do the non-sports output. So I went across with one or two others to look after her live output. And I found myself working with people like Danny Baker and Johnny Walker came across and did a mid-morning show for us. It was great. And Five was very enterprising in those days, but it struggled because it had so little resources, really. The worst or the most unsatisfying programme I ever worked on Radio 5 was an afternoon show, Monday to Friday. We called it A Game of Two Halves, which is a silly title for anything, really. Two pairs of presenters. John Inverdell and Francis Edmonds would do Monday, Wednesday and Friday. And on Tuesdays and Thursdays, it would be Mark Kermode, his first presenting job, with Karen Keating, God bless her. We had no money. We had virtually no staff, no money. We had a soap opera bought in from America called Milford Haven.
Next on Milford Haven.
I don't see how you could keep this from me for 30 years. How could you think I wouldn't find out?
So we thought, well, it's not very good, this thing. I mean, what are we going to do? So we decided we would do a little partnership with people living in the real Milford Haven in West Wales, and then we'd ring somebody up in Milford Haven to ask them what they thought of it. It quickly became quite clear that, A, the programme wasn't very good, and B, nobody had anything to say about it. So that didn't last for very long. But we were forced to do things like that.
Welcome to the brand new network and the first special holiday programme on Radio 5. Take 5. I'm Bruno Brooks. We've got some great music for you.
But Pat did a fantastic job with so little to get such good output, and there were some real wins that came out. So Room 101, for example, was a Radio 5 programme before it became a TV programme. Chain Reaction, a very good interview idea. That went well on 5. So there were lots of good things that came out of it. And I mean, working with Johnny Walker was just so big for me, because I used to listen to him when he was on Radio 1, first time around. Being his senior producer was fantastic. And at the end of every show, he would arrive with 2 minutes to go, obviously, trying to freak out these people who weren't used to music radio. He'd be in the loo somewhere, and then he'd just walk in, he'd open the mic, so they'd say, hi, press CD, and off he goes, two or three minutes to sort himself out, and then off we would go.
And a very good morning to you. On the programme today, we talk to the founders of Densa, the Thicko's answer to Mensa. We'll look at a new tax relief.
The mood in the BBC about Radio 5, I think it was regarded as the bastard child, really. Sport and education didn't seem to be natural bedfellows. So, in a way, if you're working on a network like that, making that work and making it all fit is kind of hard, really. You're on a hiding to nothing. There was quite a lot of bad press around Radio 5. People thought it was just a mishmash, a typical BBC fudge. But it never really fully did, and it was a natural outcome that eventually 5 Live took over the slot. The other thing was that Radio 5 was an opportunity for them to try different work practices. So you had a new breed of technical stroke production called programme managers. These were producers who were also operating the kit. Now, in the old, heavily unionised past, you know, no producer should touch a tape machine in the studio. 5 tried to break down those barriers. It was the arena where a lot of those changes were starting to happen.
From 5 o'clock in the morning, this frequency will carry the new news and sport network, Radio 5 Live.
After about 3 years of Radio 5, I went back to Radio 4. I'd done so much live magazine programmes in, day out, and they were just about to launch a new thing which went on air on Radio 4 as Anderson Country. Amazingly talented broadcaster Jerry Anderson from Northern Ireland was brought over to make the mid-afternoons on Radio 4 live rather than so thuddingly dull and pre-recorded. So I found myself having done so many hours and weeks and weeks and weeks of live magazine programmes. I was kind of exhausted and I wanted to make some documentaries and features for a while. And then they wanted to launch Anderson Country. Would I come and be part of the team? And I resisted at first. This was a programme, it was an hour long, live presented by Jerry Anderson, who'd come over from Belfast. And nobody knew what the programme was supposed to be. It was defined by what it couldn't be. You can't do books because we've got a book programme. You can't do this because we've got that. We can't do consumer stuff because we've got you and yours. You can't do that. And so on and so on. So we had to try and make a programme without a proper brief. Jerry Anderson, if you've ever heard him in his own environment, in Londonderry and on Radio Ulster, he was a fantastic presenter because he didn't interview people, he just talked to them. It's not the same thing, is it?
Myself and members of the listening public undertook a bus tour of the Ards Peninsula, and in the course of this tour had occasion to visit the stately home of a certain Lord Dunleith of Ballywalter. On this visit, strange things happened, which will become clear.
And what Radio 4 wanted him to become was a formal interviewer. And he kind of resisted this. He was the choice. I did the pilot programme with him. None of us were very satisfied with it, but I thought, you know, we're forcing Jerry into a place that he's not comfortable. Added to which, the reception for Anderson Country wasn't great. It was a bit like living in a wartime bunker. There were certain producers who walked down the corridor broadcasting as literally throwing themselves into doorways not to be caught talking to you, literally. It was a poison chalice for many people. But I think the experience for Jerry was turning sour, really. He did so well. I used to go over to Belfast every Friday because he had to do his TV show in Belfast on a Friday evening. So we had to do the radio show down the line from Belfast. So we'd present a Radio 4 programme from Belfast with all the other stuff happening in London. So Jerry was trying to balance many different commitments. And I think that the hostility that surrounded that programme among the Radio 4 audience, I actually took a phone call from a listener who said, why are you letting this bomber onto our airwaves? This was just because he had a Northern Irish accent. So we think of the Radio 4 audience as being a fairly sophisticated audience, but there were some nutcases out there as well. So he had a lot of pressure. Eventually, Jerry was still doing it, and I got quite exhausted. And then an opportunity came up for me to go to South Africa for a complete change, and I decided I would do that. When Mandela was released in February 1990 from 27 years of incarceration, a man called Michael Young, Lord Young of Dartington, had a brainwave. Michael Young wrote the 1945 Labour Manifesto. He started the Open University, even though Harold Wilson took credit for it. His big thing then, in 1990, was distance learning. He foresaw the need for radio to become a really important medium in South Africa. because in a population of about 40 to 45 million, there are only about 5 million televisions in South Africa, most of them in wealthy houses. The black population, something like a literacy rate of about 60 or 70%. So print medium was no good. And the aim being to educate people to their newfound freedom and to give them the ability to get their hands on the major institutions so they could run the country, understand their rights, and so on and so on. So radio, for him, he thought, was as powerful in South Africa in 1990 as it was in this country in the 1930s. So this was the South African Institute for Distance Education, and it had a radio project which was called Ulwazi. Now, Ulwazi is the Nguni word for knowledge. And the idea was to bring in black South Africans who'd come out of their own war, if you like, the apartheid war, give them skills so they could get into the communications business, so they could communicate with their people and the whole people of the country in a way that they'd never been able to do before. So no black South Africans had ever had access to radio skills or any other kind of communication skills. They weren't allowed to. There were some black newspapers. So it was very important to sort of get radio up and running as a way to galvanise the new South Africa. And he realised that, you know, you couldn't ask SABC, the state broadcaster, the voice of the bad old days, the voice of the old guard, the apartheid voice. You couldn't ask them to provide training to black South Africans. They had no credibility. So he appealed to the BBC World Service. Two of us went over. We got there in October 94. So Mandela was president by then. And we went over to share skills. We weren't trainers, we were programme makers. But meeting these people, it was a bit like, I imagine it must have been, if you'd gone to France in, let's say, late 1945, and sat down with members of the French Resistance to hear their stories, still fresh from the arena of conflict. It was a bit like that. All of the people we were working with, they'd all played their part in the struggle, as it was called. So they'd all been acting against the apartheid regime by either as go-betweens or informants or protesters or activists. And they all had these amazing stories to be. I remember one of them was electrocuted in the John Vorster Square police station, this big tower block of a police where they used to chuck people out the upstairs windows. One guy was threatened three times of being thrown out of a 10th floor window. They never actually did it, but they threatened him because they wanted him to inform. They all had stories of that kind of thing. So this was quite shocking, but very striking. It reminded us of the intensity and the importance of what we were doing. It may have been just a drop in the ocean, but it helped. And at the end of it, the idea was that they would all then go off back into their own areas of South Africa or go into jobs, into communications or anything, or politics. So we would make programmes about everybody's everyday lives in the townships, in the cities and everywhere else, and then we would give these programmes, 15-minute features, let's say, to all these stations for nothing, because they couldn't afford to make it, we could. So we weren't just training people in the abstract, we were helping them to get on air within 6 months. Now, the following year, I went back in 1996. It was the 20th anniversary of one of the key turning points in the whole fight against apartheid. It was the Soweto riots of June 1976, where the school children who were forced to learn in Afrikaans decided to rebel. They went on a peaceful protest one day. And I said, well, why don't we make a programme about that day? You've got access to all these people who were there on that day. Yeah, let's go. So we got the teacher who was in the classroom where the young student, Tietzi Mashanini, stood up and raised his fist and said, Amandla! And all the students got up and walked out of the class, joined the procession, marched through parts of Soweto. Others joined them with banners and things all came out that they'd pre-prepared, like down with Afrikaans and stuff like this. So I said, let's get people who were there on that day and remember these events, and let's record them. And we won't have a presenter, we'll just do a montage of the day, dawn to dusk. And we put together an hour-long programme where we gathered some people to come into the office in Braamfontein in Johannesburg and sit, and we played them this thing before we gave it then to the stations, so that it went out in local stations all around South Africa. SABC eventually broadcast it as well, and they all listened in complete and utter silence.
Since June the 16th, when South African troops and police opened fire on a peaceful school children's demonstration, the white government has presided over the largest massacre of its black population since South Africa came into existence. The schoolboy who led that day's protest was 19-year-old Tietzi Mashanini.
I saw a child of 8, and this kid innocently raised his fist in a black power sign and said, power.
And at the end of it, there was this long pause. And then they just all started applauding because it was a part of their history that they didn't ever expect to be told in this way. It was probably the most important experience of my radio life by far. It felt like the most important thing. But I got back to Radio 4 eventually and worked on the afternoon shift and one or two other programmes. I then became executive producer of things like Loose Ends with Ned Sherrin, Any Questions with Jonathan Dubble, which I did for 10 years, really. And I was in the middle of getting used to all of that kind of thing when we got the news that Princess Diana had been killed in a car crash in Paris. And that was a shock for everybody. But it also brought back to me all of those old experiences of working in outside broadcasts and commentary, and I was asked to lead the coverage for BBC Radio.
Goodbye, England's rose. May you ever grow in our hearts. You were the grace that placed itself.
And the first thing we did was to bring together all those old people I'd worked with in sport, the producers, the engineers, and reach for some of the commentators. We put together a team. We did in 6 days what you'd normally take 6 months to do, mainly because of these pre-existing relationships. And it did work really, really well. We had an unusual lineup of commentators. We had a lot more news voices. It was the turning point in the tone of the way we do these things. If you remember about Diana, there was a lot of criticism of the palace, of the Queen, for not being more publicly effusive, not communicating more. We've seen this in the film where Tony Blair pretends that he's advised her to come back to London from Balmoral.
But I was just wondering whether you'd seen any of today's papers.
Your candles burned out long before your legend ever.
So there was a sense in which you couldn't just go out with the normal tone of intoning the great actor's voice like Tom Fleming used to do in Westminster Abbey. We couldn't quite do that on this occasion. And the age of the woman as well. She was 36, I think, when she died. So we brought in people like Simon Mayo from Radio 1 then. Also, we weren't sure whether this was going to be a ceremonial event or a news event. There was a meeting I remember very vividly on the Friday, the day before the funeral on the Saturday, where we discussed all possibilities, like what if the Queen is booed on the streets of London? What if somebody takes a pot shot at Charles? What if somebody breaks through a barrier and runs after the coffin, weeping and wailing? How are we going to handle this? What's the tone of this event? It was really unclear, even as late as the night before, what the tone would be. So what you needed to have were the right lineup of broadcasters who were used to news events, not just ceremonial intoning, but news events. So we brought in Robin Lustig, and then Jim Nochte presented it. And we had lots of other people, and Nick Clark was part of that from The World at One. So we had the right sort of experience. So if this thing turned from a ceremonial event into a news event, we could handle it.
Of course, we wonder, will one or both of the young princes feel able to join this procession?
All of those things didn't happen. But it was still an extraordinary event. What I normally do with these big outside broadcast coverage events is go about 2 nights before. I'll walk the entire route just to see if everything's ready, just to see what they're going, see the engineers, make sure that there are no problems that we can't do something about. And walking through London on that Thursday evening, it with all the flowers, it smelt like a woodland in spring. And this hush around the place where all the flowers are piled up outside Kensington Palace gates and then again at Buckingham Palace. And we'd had a little bit of a challenge that week that the route was extended on the Wednesday. So we thought it was going to begin around St James's Palace, as you'd normally expect, somewhere near the Mall, and then go round to Westminster Abbey. But they extended it all the way back because so many people were coming into London. They thought we'd got to give them more to look at. So they started the procession now at Kensington Palace. So you've got the whole length of Hyde Park added on to the length of the route. So we got some additional commentators, people from sport. Eleanor Oldroyd was one of those. Because the engineer had rung me as soon as the announcement of the thing was. We were all saying, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? We haven't got enough kit. What are we going to do? He rang me and he said, I've got a solution. The proms are on. We've got a fully working control room in the Albert Hall. We can put a few backpacks along the South Carriage Drive along Hyde Park and we can run it from there. We can link it up, and then when they get to Hyde Park Corner, we've got the other communications already in place, so that's what we did. I remember putting Alan Little on the roof of Apsley House, the old home of the Duke of Wellington at Hyde Park Corner, up in the wind. I mean, this was all very highly improvised, but it worked. it worked because of the experience of people. And a lot of that experience was resident in the world of sport and outside broadcasts, because that's what they do all the time. It was an astonishing exercise in radio production to be part of. Huge team effort. We had Nicholas Witchell outside the Abbey and people like that. But it was a very, very interesting test. In those days, the BBC was riven by internal divisions, artificial divisions, broadcast production. This was the day when all those barriers fell away and we went back to the old days where everybody just came together and made radio. And it was a fantastic experience to be part of. But I was asked by Ron Neil, who was then head of production or whatever, to write a report after that event. If this happens again, how well are we situated to do it? Because I'd left sport back in 1990. This was 1997. And in the meantime, the old events team that I was part of had just evaporated. And all the events that we used to do, like Carols from Kings, the Cenotaph Service, had all been farmed out to other places. And things like the state opening of Parliament, Five Live was now up and running, so clearly I was part of Five Live's coverage. So there was no standing army of people. So the outcome of the report really was, we need a virtual army. There's no point in assembling an events team that's going to sit there waiting for something to happen. We can't afford that. But what we can afford to do is to draw up on paper, what are the roles, who is the ideal person for this, and then put a substitute bench with about five names alongside and all the contact names you need and everything else. And that's what we did. And I kept that plan up to date for years and years and years. And of course, that's what we did when the Queen Mother died in 2002. We brought them all back in again. So I'm slightly semi-detached now, but I'm still on a retainer to carry on helping the planning. And this is the model we're now working with.
What time now for Home Truths with John Peel.
Home Truths was deeply unpopular when it first started. And this was one of the programmes that was part of the new schedule for Radio 4 devised by James Boyle, who became quite a controversial figure because he messed about with Radio 4 so much. Actually, looking back, he probably was right most of the time, but there were little things that weren't correct. Anyway, Sport on 4 was cancelled, so no more Cliff Morgan on a Saturday morning. Loose Ends was moved to the Saturday evening. And in the middle was John Peel. They used to call him the Queen Mother of British broadcasting in those days. He was unassailable. He was a national treasure. Still on Radio 1 after all these years, playing music nobody else would play. And he would get hundreds of CDs and tapes sent to him every day. I mean, his house was in Suffolk was full of this stuff. And he listened to everything, and he'd carefully file it away. He knew exactly where everything was, and he was doing this Radio 1 show, I think it was three nights a week in those days. He was writing a column in the Radio Times about just a family life with John Peel. And he was very amusing and very funny about his teenage kids when they become difficult and what life was like on the farm, as it were. And for that, he was asked to present a programme called This Family Matters, which predated the schedule changes. Radio 4 had already spotted the fact that he was a good writer and they liked him. And again, this was a programme that didn't really have a brief. We had John Peel, that's a great thing to start with, but what are we going to put in it? I remember we did this pilot, and Peel wasn't sure he wanted to do it, really. He didn't want to be on Radio 4, he just wasn't sure, that he didn't really know what this programme was about. And we put one thing in the pilot, and it was an interview with an angler, and his big ambition was to catch this very old carp, this legendary fish. But it was the story about why he was obsessed by this carp, and also the fact that he believed the carp was so clever that he could hear the approach of the fishermen. So they used to park their car half a mile away because they believed that the carp would otherwise hear the slamming of the door, and they would crawl towards it. Once John Peel heard this and did this interview, he thought, OK, if it's going to be like this, I'll do it.
Thelma's condition doesn't, as far as we know, have a name itself, but perhaps it will after this.
I don't associate...
John Peel was a legendary broadcaster already at this point, but he wasn't the most obvious person to do lots and lots of interviews. He once said to me that radio was the perfect medium for him because he was basically quite shy, and it meant he could talk to people down the line without looking in their faces, looking in their eyes. He basically believed it was a bit rude to pry into other people's lives, which isn't a very promising place to start if you're doing an interview. But he also understood and said to me on a couple of occasions that if you talk to somebody long enough, you suddenly discover everybody's got a story to tell. So he wasn't the most natural interviewer, and we had to record long and then cut and move things about originally, but he got very good at it. But because of that diffidence in him, I think the interviewees were ordinary people, should we say, responded really well to him. They would tell him things they wouldn't tell me or anybody else. We would write a script for him. He would come from his Radio 1 show. He'd record a few interviews. He'd go back and do Radio 1 again that night. And then he'd come to see us on a Thursday morning, record Home Truths in the morning, and then he'd drive back to Suffolk. my role. I think he saw my role as bringing the bottle of red wine in at the end of the studio so he could have a glass of wine before he went. Peel was amazing because he eventually galvanised the Ready For audience. The Ready For audience just fell in love with him. So from the early days, the early first year, when we were heavily criticised by the commissioning editors in Ready For, they gave us a torrid time, to about a year or two later when the programme won 4 Sony Gold Awards all at the same time. In fact, it would have won 5, but Peel only got the silver. He was really, really pissed off about that. Part of some of the production had had some experience of this before. Anderson Country, Afternoon Shift. They understood what it was like to be working on unpopular output, but Peel was the king. When I took him out for a drink to talk to him about doing the programme, he said, there's only 2 things I would insist on. He said, don't turn me into a Radio 4 broadcaster. I am what I am. I'm too late to change. I will just do what I do. And the other thing I agreed with him on is, let's make it a celebrity-free zone. You shouldn't have heard of any of these people before when we talked to them. They're just real people with real lives. Let's just do that. You know, he made it a success.
I'm off now. Off, in fact, for a couple of weeks. Recharging the batteries, getting on with the book, that sort of thing. And that nice David Stafford will be bringing you home truths until my return. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
He invited us to his 60th birthday party, the whole team, which he held in the field next to his house in Great Finborough in Suffolk. And his wife had flown in some band from Africa to play for it. And he had the local farmers band also. He always invited the local farmers band to do a slot at his party. And I said, well, thanks very much for inviting me, John. And he said, I'm very happy to have you there, but I want you to know, Peter, that you're just about as far up the food chain as I'm prepared to go in the BBC. And he said, by the way, what does an executive producer do? What's an executive producer for? But no, he was a very popular colleague. Everybody enjoyed working with him. He was just naturally funny. He was as good a storyteller off air as he was on air. I remember there was a day when he came in wearing a jacket. He never wore jackets. A sports jacket, a blazer, a grey blazer. He would always wear old T-shirts and sweatshirts and jeans. And I said, that's a very nice jacket, John. Where'd you get that? He said, well, Sheila bought it for me, his wife, Sheila. And he said, it fitted as well. I thought, great, this is great. He said, I wore it to an event the other night. He said, I thought I looked like James Bond. And then I caught sight of myself in a mirror and all I saw was a fat bloke in a jacket. That was typical Peel. And when he died, you know, of a heart attack, he was in South America at the time. He'd had a history of, well, his family had had a history of heart problems. His father died young, died in his 60s. And Peel, I remember when he got to that age, was a little bit nervous about reaching the age that his father died, and he predicted that he wouldn't last much longer. Now, he wasn't far out, actually, as it turned out, but we couldn't have known that. But it was a huge loss. Home Truths carried on for quite a while with different people, but it couldn't last because whenever Peel was there, it was the programme it was and people liked it. Whenever John Peel wasn't there, and this is me working on the programme, I was never quite sure what sort of programme it was without John Peel. But the other thing to say about that was even the great John Peel had the anxiety of the performer. All bad behaviour in broadcasting among broadcasters, I think, is basically about insecurity. Even when John had to take a week off and we'd bring in Roger McGough or somebody else to do it, you could tell the look in his eye. He secretly feared that you'd prefer the replacement to him. There couldn't have been a presenter more unassailable than John at that time. But even he had that little anxiety that a lot of performers have. Because it's that old relationship between a producer and a presenter, isn't it? If you're the broadcaster and you make an error on air, you make an error on air. You look stupid. If the producer makes an error behind the glass, it's still the broadcaster that might look stupid. So of course you're going to be a bit wary about that relationship. And I think Peel was a very good example of how even the best people get this anxiety gene. And you've got to understand that as a producer. You've got to work around it, go work with it. But no, his death was a great loss. And I think Home Truths had to end at some point after that.
Hello, and we have to use that rather informal greeting on account of you might be listening at this very moment, 10 o'clock Saturday the 4th of July, or you might be listening at this very moment, 11
for,
o'clock
For about
night.
10 years, I was the executive producer, or de facto editor, of programmes like Loose Ends with Ned Sherrin and Clive Anderson, and also Any Questions, which I loved doing. Dealing with politicians, being out and about, doing a good old-fashioned OB in somewhere in the land every Friday night. It's a simple OB and it still works. It's been like that for about 70 years.
On our panel here, Ken Livingston is out of his old job but not out of work. Aspiring one day to serve a third term as Mayor of London, he spends much of his time travelling the world.
Eventually, I just needed another change. And about 2008, they needed somebody to run Proms in the Park. you'll know that obviously the prom season is well known, and the last night only a certain number of people can get into the hall, so they, at some point back in the mid-90s, they decided to put a concert on over the road in the park, in Hyde Park, so that people who couldn't get in could go and have their own version of it, and then they were joined by a big screen link with the Albert Hall for all the flag waving and the Rule Britannia that comes at the end of it. But the concert in the park had its own orchestra, you know, its own guest stars, and you know, really high-profile people, Carreras, Kiri Takanawa, Tom Jones. It was a mixture of light classical and popular music. Kylie's done it, we did an ABBA concert. And I'd never worked quite at that scale before. I'd done big outside broadcasts, but I'd never done a big event at that scale. So 40,000 people in a park with a massive 35-metre stage and an orchestra and all these big stars coming on. That was great. I loved doing that. I did that for 5 years. And I, every Saturday we'd do Proms in the Park. Every Sunday we would then do another concert for Radio 2. And it's now become Radio 2 Live in Hyde Park. But working at that scale was a big thing for me. But I committed myself then not to being the programme maker anymore, but to being the events organiser. And that was a whole new world. And I recruited some people in to my team that I knew were far better at it than I was, so they were great to have as supporters. Proper project managers, proper organisers. And we did lots of different things. We did, the Hyde Park thing was one, then we started again the BBC's presence at the Edinburgh Festival. So you take a site, Potterrow, in the old town of Edinburgh, near the Gilded Balloon and some of the other big venues, take over this big square car park sized plot of land, you build a garden, you build a tent with a theatre inside it, the radio theatre inside the tent, effectively 300 or 400 seater, fully capable for television and for radio. We had all the networks come, all of 7 radio networks. We had the One Show came, you know, so over those years it became a massive event. Typical BBC story is that, of course, the funding for it was never nailed down until about a week before you actually did it, you know, so it's silly, really. Same was true of Proms in the Park. So I became an events organiser, is the live events, and we did many, many award shows, food awards, the drama awards, things of that sort, and did some shows abroad. I'm semi-detached. I left the staff in about 2015. I'm now freelance because I'm on a retainer to carry on helping shape royal plans. So when the Queen goes and when Philip goes, we've got some big events to do, and that's important to have continuity of experience in the planning, so that's why they've kept me involved, although others have now come in, that's great. And I'm doing the occasional foreign OB. I love that. I love all of that. Not too much of it, but I love all of that. But I suppose the biggest thing to sign off with was the funeral of Mandela in 2013, because it was an extension of the kind of ceremonial coverage I've been doing. And of course, this was meant to be a joint programme with Radio 4, 5 and World Service. And in the end, what we did was we built our own studio in Johannesburg. The bureau was in Johannesburg then. And next door to it, quite a large bureau with 2 studios, but the studios were so busy, we couldn't take over one of them to equip it properly for the kind of coverage we needed to do. So Peter Burden, who was then the bureau chief in Africa, he quickly acquired the next door office, which had been vacated by ABC, I think, from Sydney. They'd left that office, gone somewhere else. So we got the lease on the office, and we punched a hole in the wall between the two spaces, stuck a door in, and we had a complete studio space to build. So we built a studio from scratch. It had a dividing wall already in it with glass, but nothing else. So I took some OB engineers out to Johannesburg when it finally happened. They'd literally built the studio that could manage a big event, and that's where we produced the coverage from. The funeral plans were moving around for 3 or 4 years. In fact, there were 3 funerals being planned at one point. There was the family, there was the ANC, and there was the government. And they didn't agree about what kind of funeral it was going to be, or even where it was going to be. Originally, it was going to be Pretoria. Then it thought, now it's too establishment. Let's take him back to his country, down to Kounou, down in the Eastern Cape, which is what eventually happened. I had a grab bag packed downstairs in the bedroom for about 2 years. Because we thought it was going to happen any day, that Mandela was ill, he was going to die any day. But that was an amazing way for me of almost completing the circle from when I first went to South Africa because of Mandela and the changes that came, to then being able to say goodbye to him by managing that broadcast. That was a very satisfying thing, personally. The coverage was fine, I thought, for the World Service and for Five Live, but the dead hand of security lay over that whole event. Nobody wanted anything to go wrong. So where was the singing? Where were the kids? Where was the people walking from city to city? Where were they? Where was all this kind of exuberant thing that was associated with the Mandela effect? None of it was there. It was all very official, very managed, and so on.
Literally hundreds lining the whole of this street, which is about, I would say, half a mile from the Union Building, which is the highest point of Pretoria. Only a short winding road from here to this vast, impressive building where the body of Nelson Mandela will lie in state. Just looking around right now, you can hear people chanting Nelson Mandela. I can see the flags.
I still have a sense of the privilege of being in radio. I mean, being paid to tell stories to the world is a fantastic pleasure. And I've never lost the thrill of seeing the red light go on the wall and you're live to the world. Now tell your story. That's always given me a bit of a buzz. And I think, despite all the other things that I've done since, I think my time in sport and outside broadcast was the most formative time. I learned more there than anywhere else. And actually, we all get together around Christmas time. We have a drink up in the West End. Producers, past and present, broadcasters, past and present. And we all say the same thing, that our time in sport was in some way the best of time. And I've certainly felt that. I've carried that with me for many years now, because it's quite a while since I was there. But if you'd asked me what was the most important or significant experience in my radio life, I think I'd have to say South Africa. Because I felt I was, for the first time, I was really able to make a difference. So that has always lived in me ever since. Oh, I think my father was... I think he was delighted that I'd gone into a world that he knew something of. I think he probably thought I was a bit aimless. I think he knew I was quite a hard worker. I mean, I loved my years in university. I worked really hard. I read loads and loads of books and did everything. But I think he didn't think I really had a focus about what I wanted to do. And when it turned out to be the BBC, I think he was secretly pleased. And he knew, of course, that he'd led me to that open door. And I had a real sense of following in his footsteps. And he was the inspiration for me going to the BBC. And I was really thoroughly pleased. So when I used to go back to Cardiff to see him, as I did when he was still alive, he'd ask me all about it, and we'd talk about it. And I'd say, oh, I did this. Oh, that reminds me of the thing that happened to me. So we kind of had an extra thing to bond about, really. So I think he was pleased and happy that both his sons, my brother became a professor of physics, I think he was happy that both his sons had ended up in places where they could enjoy what they were being paid to do.